Good afternoon and welcome along to another edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley and this is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week here on Premier Christian Radio as part of our Faith Explored range of shows. And if you want to find out more about the programme, listen to past programmes, and why not join the many Christians and non-Christians who listen to this programme around the world. Go to premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. You can find further articles, features, videos and more there as well, including of course links to this year's Unbelievable the Conference on DVD and audio CD. Over 12 hours of material, tons of speakers and all the different seminars that took place available on two handy discs. You can order it for yourself at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Just scroll down, follow the links, and we're making a digital edition available as well. So do check out that as well. Got links there, of course, to Unbelievable Live as well. So much to tell you about at the moment. That's in a week's time, just north of LA in the USA. So if you live in the California area, or you're in striking distance at least of where we're doing that in Northridge, California, I'd love to meet you there. I'll be hosting a dialogue between Sean McDowell and Ryan Bell and telling you a bit about Unbelievable as well. More details are from the link at the website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable, and I'll tell you a bit more about that later on the programme as well. Squeezing in an interview before the end of today's show as well with Scott Klussendorf about the Clarkson Academy. It's a weekend of pro-life apologetics training, so Scott will be along to tell us about that towards the end of today's show. But we're doing a philosophical debate on Unbelievable today. Let me tell you who's joining me and what our subject is.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're asking, is believing in God properly basic? We're debating Alvin Plantinga's Reformed epistemology today, bit of a philosophical edition of the programme. What does it mean for a belief to be properly basic? Well, we'll be hearing about that from Tyler McNabb. He's a PhD student at the University of Glasgow, specialising in epistemology and philosophy of religion. He's been heavily influenced by Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga. He even uses so-called Reformed epistemology in street evangelism. We'll be finding out about that. The Reformed epistemology and properly basic beliefs is a notion that philosopher Alvin Plantinga has popularised. And we're going to be asking today, can Christians be justified in their belief in God, even if they don't necessarily have exhaustive evidence for God? So against Tyler today, Stephen Law is an atheist philosopher, well known on this programme, been on a number of times. He's provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK. He's engaged on the Reformed epistemology issues plenty of times on his blog, and has engaged Alvin Plantinga himself actually on this programme a few years ago, though that was in regard to the evolutionary argument against naturalism. If you want to search back in the archives, you can find that fantastic debate that was. And I'll make sure there are links to both my guests, Stephen and Tyler, their blogs and so on, from today's website at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Tyler and Stephen, welcome along to the programme.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. You're both joining me by the wonders of Skype. Tyler, you're currently actually out in the US, though, as I say, you're normally based in Glasgow for this PhD you're doing. Do you want to tell us how you fell into philosophy, Tyler?
Sure, yeah. So I actually just ended up turning in my PhD thesis. So I'm currently in the waiting for the defense mode.
Okay.
Which is why I'm in the States. But I was an agnostic at one point for a very short time, and was about to jump on the ship of nihilism, and then I sort of asked God, "Hey, I'm about to become an atheist, and you better show me that you're there, or else that's going to happen." And that night, I came across Isaiah 53 and some other what theologians call messianic prophecies about the Messiah, and found myself believing that, hey, this Jesus is the Messiah. And the next day, I had a really significant religious experience.
Mm-hmm.
And this continued me on the track to really be interested in evidence for God and for what it means to be rational, believing in God.
Mm.
So that's roughly
the very encapsulated version of your story. I mean, you grew up, I think, in a Christian background, a Christian family, but had this sort of crisis of faith. Obviously, philosophy and Reformed epistemology in particular, as I understand it, has been helpful to you in kind of getting a rational grounding for what you believe, and not kind of moving away from the idea that you have to kind of know everything in order to be able to believe in God.
Yeah, there was a time where I was, sometime after my conversion, where I was plagued by sort of Cartesian doubt. I felt that I had to meet this sort of requirement that in order for my belief to be justified or rational, it had to be sort of an infallible belief, a belief that I couldn't be wrong about. And so this of course is a pretty intense burden to bear for any belief.
Mm-hmm.
Upon reading Alvin Plantinga's Warranted Christian Belief as a grad student, immediately I realized, wait a minute, I can trust my basic intuitions. I can trust what appears to me to be the case, and it doesn't have to be such where it's impossible for me to be wrong about it. And this was very liberating and really sort of got me going and reading and defending Plantinga's arguments.
I mean, would you say Plantinga is probably the most influential Christian philosopher alive today?
Yeah, I mean, I take so. Even at the University of Glasgow, where I was at, everyone had a very healthy respect for Plantinga's works, both secular and I think religious, at least to a certain degree, more so, I think, than any other philosopher. But I think the only sort of comparable individual would be someone like Richard Swinburne. Those two in general, I think it's not much of an argument that those two are indeed the most influential Christian philosophers of our time.
Yeah. Just briefly before we come to Stephen, you've even used Reformed epistemology and these ideas, which many people might think are reserved purely for the halls of academia and philosophy and so on. You've actually used them even in street preaching, I understand.
That's right. So I still street preach. It's a really good tool to talk with individuals about their questions and objections to the existence of God or to the rationality of theism. And so I'll start off, go into a very populated area, find somewhere where I could stand, and just sort of open up and make certain claims like, if God exists, we can know that he exists. And sort of start off from there, explaining sort of the Reformed epistemology model, and using that to then talk about sin and the gospel, and hopefully answer questions that are available.
What sort of, I'm fascinated by this because, you know, many people think of street preaching as your typical turn or burn sort of loud people.
Sure.
With a megaphone. You're a PhD philosophy student and lecturer and so on, and it may seem like an odd place to be doing this, but what's the kind of reaction you get?
You usually do get sort of like at least an initial reaction of either sarcasm or hostility. Usually though, once they see that I'm really interested in dialogue, I really am interested in sort of carrying on a discussion. It usually does turn a bit. I mean, I've had some times where there's, you know, 50, 60 people standing there and we're just constantly answering objections and answers and having a very nice public dialogue, you know. So I would say generally,
yeah.
And
you find that people grasp even in that context, that sort of quickfire context, the basic principles you're trying to get across.
Absolutely. I think both the philosophical principles as well as the most important principles of the gospel.
Right. Well, look, I'm looking forward to you unpacking that for us a bit in the course of today's program.
Sure.
We've never done properly, if you like, a discussion on this idea of properly basic beliefs and so on. So the perfect person, I think, to put the other side of this argument, joining us also by Skype, is Stephen Law. Stephen's been on the program a number of times before. As I mentioned, he's an atheist. He's the provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK. And he's engaged in issues of Reformed epistemology plenty of times on his blog over the years. Welcome back to the program, Stephen.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
I wanted to get you on because I know that you've engaged a number of times on this issue. So just briefly, first of all, what's been going on for you recently? It's been a little while since you've been on the programme.
I've been working on academic papers. I published one in Australasian Journal of Philosophy on natural kinds, nothing to do with religion at all. But I've also been working on some papers in philosophy of religion. I've just got one called The Exclaim Argument Against Religious Belief in Religious Studies. I've been doing some stuff on the work of Michael Bergman also. And I've just got a contract with OUP to write a book called The Evil God Challenge.
Ah, The Old Evil God Challenge. The official yeah. The official book, sounds like. Well, that sounds like a very good reason to have you back on once that's... That's improved.
Yeah, be the book of the film. Yeah.
Yeah. You saw it live at Westminster Central Hall. Now read it. Yes, good stuff. Well, for those who aren't familiar with the Evil God Challenge, again, I can ask you to look back in the archives of Unbelievable when I think it was with a while back.
Glenn Peoples.
Glenn Peoples. Yes.
I can't even remember what we talked about.
I think it was the Evil God Challenge. I think that.
Oh yes, it was. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Anyway, lovely to have you back on, Stephen. Thank you for coming on today. We're talking about, is believing in God properly basic? We're debating Alvin Plantinga's reformed epistemology today. Tyler McNabb, our Christian philosopher. Stephen Law, our atheist philosopher today. It's a philosophical edition of the programme. I think you're going to learn a lot. So am I, actually, in the course of today's show. Now, if you'd like to get in touch and respond to anything you hear, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is, of course, the email address. And you can find us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Why not leave a thought, a comment underneath the latest edition of the programme? Lots of people do that every week. You can find, of course, the podcast features, loads of other material as well, and of course the back catalogue of shows where you can hear other debates that Stephen's taken part in over the years. Don't forget to, we're also available via social media sites. That's @UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to follow us on Facebook.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So let's come back to you now, Tyler. I think we need to get to grips with what this idea of properly basic beliefs is all about, why we would be interested in having those as Christians, and generally how this fits into another technical term, reformed epistemology. So we're going to try and boil this down for the sake of listeners, especially me, who may not be familiar with all these terms as well. So we'll give you a bit of a chance to do that now, Tyler. If you want to take us from the beginning and run us through this particular way of looking at philosophy.
Sure. And first, I do want to say it's a pleasure to meet you, Stephen. I've been following your career for, like, ever since I was in grad, my master's degree. So I appreciate you coming on here and dialoguing with me.
No, it's a pleasure to meet you. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
All righty. So I take reformed epistemology to be the thesis that one can be justified or warranted in their belief that God exists apart from argumentation. All right, so what exactly, if we can unpack that, what exactly does that mean? To be justified, I take it that I'm using the word justification here in a sense that I've sort of done my duty when I form my belief. I'm not forming my belief irresponsibly. Mm-hmm. There's a popular theory, especially currently, called phenomenal conservatism. This roughly states something like, as long as the belief formed from the individual, as long as it appears to them that that's the case, that a proposition is true, and the individual is without a defeater for thinking that that proposition is true, then that individual is justified in affirming that that proposition is true. So it really seems that way to me, that P. And if I'm without a defeater for thinking that's not the case, then I'm justified in affirming that P. Now, notice I did say that there are defeaters. Like it's possible to have a defeater. So, for example, I might form the belief that the Earth isn't moving, but upon learning about new scientific information, I find out that indeed that belief has just been defeated.
I mean, it's not that new, the information. Galileo did come up with it a little while ago. But yes, I get the idea. Yeah. So we might think something and think we're justified in believing because to all of our senses, it appears that we're not moving. But then we find out some other new information which defeats that belief.
That's right. And I was just sort of speaking as an individual who sort of not naive individual who finds this. I wasn't making any sort of historical claim.
No.
But, and so so I'm gonna leave justification there for a second, and then I'm gonna talk about another concept called warrant. But I'm gonna come back to justification.
Okay.
Warrant is supposed to be that sort of ingredient that turns mere true belief into knowledge. So I can have a true belief, say the 76ers, an NBA basketball team for my British friends who aren't aware, and a basketball team who's pretty bad.
Okay.
So if I just sort of find myself believing, yeah, the 76ers, they're going to go 82-0 next year, and they're going to win the NBA championship, never lose a game with the current roster that they have now.
Mm-hmm.
If I just sort of found myself believing this, and it did turn out to be true, few people would want to say that I knew that, that I knew the 76ers would win. Right? So there's a distinction between just having a true belief and indeed actually having something like knowledge.
Okay.
And so think about it almost as if you're baking you're formulating a stew, you're pouring a drink, you're mixing a drink, and you're missing a particular ingredient to really have that particular stew or to truly have that drink that you're trying to make.
Mm.
Well, that missing ingredient here is warrant.
Okay.
So you have these concepts of justification and of warrant. One popular theory of warrant that I hold to, I actually defend in my work, is called proper functionalism. It's defended by both naturalists and theists. So the most famous naturalist would be someone like Peter Graham. Theist, obviously Alvin Plantinga. Also, I know myself, Bergman, Stephen Long just mentioned him. Kenny Boyce and Andrew Moon and some others. And it basically states that in order for a person to be warranted in believing, in order for their belief to be warranted in believing that P, that belief needs to be formed by way of properly functioning cognitive faculties, which are in the environment for which they were designed. Those faculties need to be aimed at truth. And there needs to be a high objective probability of the belief being produced under these conditions being true. Plantinga later on added a sort of a no-defeater deflector clause that basically says, you know, you need to reflect appropriately for defeaters given the situation.
Okay. So kind of that again, a lot of terminology in there.
Sure.
That might be a little bit difficult to get to grips with. So boiling that down, what does
yes.
that mean? That we basically, we're justified in believing things if our brains are kind of functioning as they should be in the right kind of environment in which they're designed to function, and we've properly reflected on possible things that might defeat our beliefs. Is that the general idea?
Yeah, that's the general idea. The heart of it is if the belief is warranted, if it comes from properly functioning faculties, you know, our mental capacities that are aimed at truth.
So if we had a major blow to the head and we suddenly started believing that I was Napoleon Bonaparte.
Gotcha.
That,
okay.
This would be an example of not fulfilling these criteria.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
So where does this kind of lead us then? If all of these sort of criteria are met,
yeah,
would you make the case then that for a Christian who believes in God, that belief meets these criteria of being properly basic, that you're entitled to believe in God without necessarily having evidential evidence or argumentation per se?
So I mean, before you sort of understand it in a philosophy of religion sense, it might be helpful to think about it with more everyday sort of non-religious beliefs. So for example, if I was designed to produce a belief that other minds were in this room or were talking to me and my faculties were functioning properly, you know, aimed at truth and so on, then my belief could be warranted that I was talking to other minds. Similarly, if my faculties were designed to accept testimonial beliefs and my faculties were functioning properly, when you told me your name is Justin, if the other conditions are there and so on, then I could be warranted in my belief that your name is Justin.
Mm. So, just coming back to that issue of other minds, I mean, the point there being, as I understand it, Tyler, we don't have, in a sense, you know, absolute proof that other minds exist. We maybe have reason to believe we have a mind, but we're kind of taking it for granted that other people have the same experience as us and there are these other independent minds about. And so is the belief that the belief in other minds existing, what, you know, one of those properly basic beliefs, because it's almost sort of intuitive, we kind of have to accept it in order to get on with life and kind of function normally.
Yeah, that's right. And I do actually think that does well with cognitive science, that when we see the development of the mind and how that is, that we are indeed hardwired, if you'd say. I believe that belief can be warranted apart from argument. And so now applying that to religious beliefs, if God exists and he's designed our cognitive faculties, our mental processes, mm-hmm. in such a way as to produce belief in him under the right set of circumstances, the right sort of environment, say, the star, seeing the sky at night, seeing all the beautiful stars, I just sort of find myself believing that there's transcendent agency behind it, or perhaps I commit a moral failure and I find myself believing that God's upset with me, mm-hmm. or perhaps when I come home from work and my young children, they run to me and say, Daddy, and I find myself very strongly believing that God exists. If I'm designed to produce belief that he exists or that he's done something under these sorts of conditions or under this sort of environment, and my faculties are functioning properly and they're aimed towards truth and so on, then it would seem that my belief that God did something would indeed be a warranted belief, even if I was without argument. And then similarly for the view of phenomenal conservatism, when we're talking about justification, which I made a distinction between that and warrant, if I just sort of find myself, it really seems to me that God did something or that God exists, then I'd be justified. There's nothing really more for me to do if it really appears to me, and I don't have a defeater for thinking not, then, you know, what more do you want? I'd be justified in believing that God exists.
A really interesting way of looking at things, and I'm sure is going to provide lots of interest for the rest of the show in this dialogue with Stephen Law. And Stephen had to give Tyler, obviously, a little bit of time to lay out the whole area there. Does that broadly correspond with what you understand properly basic beliefs and the arguments for God from it to be, more or less the way you see things?
Yes, that was great. That was pretty accurate, as far as I can tell, and... it was very clear, I thought. So okay. It might help if we use a few more examples to kind of illustrate.
I think that would be really good. Go along. Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah. Feel free to do that. I think analogies and metaphors and pictures are always helpful to illustrate these somewhat cranial things, aren't they? Stephen, where would you begin with this? When did you, first come across this? And what was your initial response to it? Did you think there was anything in it? Or what are the major flaws for you?
Well, back in the 1980s, when I was doing the BPhil at Oxford, I remember finding out about externalist theories of knowledge, as they're known, and in particular, reliabilist theories of knowledge, of which Plantinga is offering a version, and thinking, gosh, a lot of people are going to be who believe in spooky stuff are going to be very excited about this, because what these accounts do is they allow people to say correctly that they know certain things despite the fact that they can't provide any what we would ordinarily call supporting evidence or argument in favor of what they believe. They can say, and they might be right, I just know. You know, I just know in my heart that God is real, mm-hmm. and that Jesus loves me. I just know that my dead Auntie Mary is in the room with me. I just know I've got a guardian angel, and so on. So it's a very attractive theory of knowledge so far as those who believe in those kinds of things are concerned. And I have to say, I think that I don't endorse Plantinga's particular version of an externalist theory of knowledge. But I think that some form of externalism is probably correct. So maybe I should just say an externalist theory of knowledge is roughly speaking one where you can be in a position to know something just because you're hooked up to the world or the state of affairs that makes your belief true in the right kind of way. So as long as there's an orange on the table in front of me and I've got my eyes open and my sensory mechanisms are operating properly in such a way that if there is an orange there, I'm going to believe it, and if there isn't, then I'm not, for example, on one theory, then I can know that there's an orange on the table. But I don't have to know that these conditions are met. Right. Mm. Just as long as they are met, I'm a knower. But I can be entirely ignorant of the philosophy of the philosophical issues concerned, and of epistemological theories and so on. I don't need to know that these conditions are met. Just so long as they are, I can know there's an orange on the table. So even a small child that knows nothing of philosophy and nothing about how their eyes work can know that there's an orange on the table in front of them on an externalist theory of knowledge. And so similarly, someone can know, it's claimed, that God exists or that their dead Auntie Mary is in the room with them or whatever it may happen to be, just so long as they're hooked up to God or their dead Auntie Mary by some appropriate truth-sensitive mechanism.
Okay.
And that is, of course, the claim that people make. Psychics claim they have such mechanisms. Spiritualists claim they have such mechanisms. Religious people claim they have such mechanisms and so on. And, of course, they might be right. But I rather doubt it.
Okay. Well, look, I'm going to come back to you in a moment's time, Stephen, because we're already at the end of the first part. We had to take some time to let Tyler explain things, and we'll hear more of your response to it in a moment's time. Doing a philosophical edition of Unbelievable today, asking, is believing in God properly basic? We're debating Alvin Plantinga's reformed epistemology, my Christian guest Tyler McNabb, my atheist guest Stephen Law. We'll be back in a moment's time. Well, no need to dream about it. If you live in the States and you can make it to California, why not consider dropping into a church, specifically Church Every Day in Northridge, California, on Saturday the 27th of August, where we're going to be recording Unbelievable Live. Yes, I'll be hosting our first international edition of the programme with an audience present, as I'm joined by atheist Ryan Bell and Christian Sean McDowell. Both will share their stories, why I'm an atheist, why I'm a Christian. Sean is a Christian apologist, and Ryan lost his faith after embarking on a year without God, which went viral at the time on the Huffington Post. They'll be discussing with me faith, reason, and the search for truth. I'll also be sharing some of my own experience in 10 years of hosting Unbelievable, and we'll be taking questions from the audience. If you can't make it, you'll be able to hear the recording in September on the podcast. But if you can be there, I'm really looking forward to meeting American Unbelievable listeners, both Christian and non-Christian, at this unique event being put on in partnership with Truth Matters Ministries. It's free to attend on Saturday, the 27th of August. The doors open at 6:30 p.m., but please register at the website truthmattersministries.com or search for Unbelievable Live on eventbrite.com. See you there.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. Unbelievable regularly engages the big ideas, and we sometimes tackle philosophical issues. And today, really, for the first time, we're probably honing in on the idea of properly basic beliefs. Now, if you live and exist in the world of apologetics as I do, you will have come across this idea. Alvin Plantinga is the one who's popularised it, the Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga. Can Christians be justified in their belief in God, even apart from argumentation and evidence necessary? necessarily. Tyler McNabb says yes, they can be. Tyler is a PhD student, actually just completed it, at the University of Glasgow, specialising in epistemology and philosophy of religion. Even uses these particular arguments in street evangelism to persuade people of the truth of God and Christianity. Stephen Law is an atheist philosopher, provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK, and he's engaged on these issues a number of times on his blog, even engaged Alvin Plantinga himself on this programme a few years ago. Go and check out their websites, by the way, tylerdaltonmcnabb.com for Tyler, Stephen blogs at stephenlaw.blogspot.co.uk, or look him up at the Centre for Inquiry UK as well. And be interested in getting your responses as well to this issue. Perhaps you're a philosopher and want to get in touch. Perhaps you're just a layperson on these issues, a bit like me, but are interested to hear the arguments for and against this particular idea. Do get in touch. unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you can of course get in touch also via the social media accounts, and all of the links and more available from today's website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and get hold of today's program. We'll be hearing some of your feedback, by the way, later on in the program, and hearing what you had to say on recent editions of the program. So coming back to you, Stephen, you've explained in that last section, there's something to what you call externalist views, which kind of allow you to be happy to know that there is an orange on the table in front of you, for instance. But you said, but hang on, can we apply this to issues like believing in God, or that your Aunt Mabel is in the room with you at the when the psychic tells you they are, and so on? Okay, so what's the false leap that's going on as far as you're concerned when it comes to Reformed epistemology?
Well, I would it's hard to know where to start, but I'll start with the thought that it's reasonable to believe that there's an orange on the table in front of me, just so long as it really looks like there is an orange on the table in front of me, and I've no reason to suspect there's something, you know, funny going on. Darren Brown isn't in the room pulling his usual tricks and so on. So
funny you should mention Darren Brown, actually, Stephen. I've got an interview with him coming up in very shortly. Oh, okay. On the program. And I did ask him not to pull any funny tricks on me during it.
I'm a big fan of Darren Brown anyways, which is why I mentioned him. So this thought that it's reasonable to believe things on the basis of how things appear, you know, ceteris paribus, other things being equal. I mean, I'm fairly happy to sign up to that, and so is Tyler. And it's sometimes called this principle of phenomenal conservatism. But it's basically, you know, if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck and so on, it's probably a duck. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's probably the way to understand it. And so, you know, if it seems to me very strongly that God exists, then it's reasonable for me to accept that God exists if I have no reason to think that there's anything funny going on. But unfortunately, there's very good reason to think there's something funny going on. And that's the bit that I would like to focus on first.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, it's reasonable for me. Suppose I look and I see that what appears to be a snake lying in the grass in front of me. The principle of phenomenal conservatism says, well, if that's how it looks to you, Stephen, then you're entitled to believe that there's a snake there, as long as you don't have any reason to think there's anything funny going on. And at this point, let's suppose that I don't. So it's reasonable for me to believe that there's a snake there. But if I now get new information, then it might be reasonable for me to revise my opinion. So, for example, if I'm told that I have been given a drug which causes incredibly realistic snake hallucinations, and if I'm given very good, very convincing evidence that this is in fact the case, then I now have very good reason to distrust my experience. This is what's known sometimes as an undercutting defeater, all right? It's not that I've got good grounds for thinking that there isn't a snake there, but I no longer have good grounds for supposing that there is a snake there, because I no longer have good, you know, I now have pretty good reason for distrusting the experience that I'm having in these circumstances that I'm having it. Mm. Another classic example, perhaps the best known example, is the widget case, where I'm looking at red objects passing by on a conveyor belt. Let's call them widgets. Mm-hmm. And they look red. So I come to believe that they're red, and that's perfectly reasonable then, given the principle of phenomenal conservatism. But then I come to possess very good evidence that I'm viewing the widgets under a certain kind of special light that reveals imperfections, and that this light makes everything look red, whether it's red or not. Okay. Given this new information, it's no longer reasonable for me to believe that the widgets are red. They may be red, and there may be a snake lying in the grass in front of me, but I can't be confident that that is the case anymore. Right. Yeah. It may be, in fact, that I'm hooked up to the snake or to the widgets by means of a reliable, truth-functioning, sort of truth-sensitive, properly functioning mechanisms. That may well be the case. But even if it is the case, the fact is it's not reasonable for me to retain these beliefs given this new information. And so the question arises, do we possess that kind of new information when it comes to trusting religious experiences, experiences that your dead auntie's in the room with you, experiences of angels and demons and spirit guides and fairies and God knows what else? And I would suggest that yeah, obviously we do.
I mean, so far what you've described is all in line with what Tyler described as these various things, criteria that your beliefs need to meet in terms of in the absence of defeating other defeaters and your cognitive faculties being, generally trustworthy and so on. So at one level, when you give these examples of ways in which your brain could be malfunctioning slightly and make you think you see a snake when there isn't one there, all sounds covered by what Tyler said. But you believe actually the belief in God, there are things that there are basically defeaters and reasons why you shouldn't necessarily trust your cognitive faculties on that particular belief, and you're about to tell me them, I'm guessing.
Yeah, well, we just have, human beings, an extraordinary track record of getting it wrong when it comes to these kinds of experience. Even within the category of religious belief, you find very many different religious beliefs, people claiming experiences of God or gods with different characteristics, mm-hmm. different numbers of gods and so on. So we know immediately that there's considerable unreliability when it comes to these kinds of experience. But actually, religious experiences of that sort are merely an instance of a far more broad category of experience about which we know we are hugely unreliable. And that's experiences of extraordinary hidden agency. Every society is huge. You will find people who believe maybe in gods or angels or demons or nature spirits or their dead relatives being around them or whatever it might happen to be. Beings that are hidden from our ordinary senses, but some of us at least have special senses that allow us to detect these beings in our vicinity and perhaps receive messages from them. Psychic Sally has that ability, apparently. And it seems to me that we know that in very, very many of these cases, these experiences, which people find incredibly compelling, are incredibly convincing. People will stake their lives on these experiences, but we know that these experiences are, in very, very many cases, deceptive. Mm. We know because, in many cases, the experiences have been debunked. We know that what people thought they experienced wasn't actually there at all. You know, go and take out a subscription to Skeptical Inquirer magazine, and you'll find dozens of examples of this in each month's issue. So given that we are so highly unreliable about making judgments that there is some extraordinary hidden agency present on the basis of some sort of, you know, subjective experience, anyone that comes to the conclusion that they or decides that there is such a being on the basis of such experience, given this new information, is in the same position as the person that finds out that they've been drugged with the drug that makes them think snakes are there, or the person that's told that they've that the widgets that they're looking at are lit by a red light that makes everything look red.
Yeah.
They have an undercutting defeater.
And I've often heard it said, and I presumably you probably go with this, Stephen, that our, if you like, hyperactive agency detection that's responsible for fooling us, is kind of on the basis of evolution. It's been helpful in the past to assume there's a tiger in the grass if the grass is rustling.
Yes, we've moved. And so yeah, on. Exactly. So it's so well known now that we are horribly prone to error when it comes to hidden agency that scientists are now developing theories to account for that error. And so one of the theories is this theory that we have evolved to be oversensitive to agency because, you know, if your environment contains agents and you miss them, they may kill you or eat you. You know, a saber-toothed tiger may eat you, for example. That's another agent. Whereas if you over-detect agency, it doesn't cost you very much. So we've evolved in such a way that when you hear a rustle in the bushes behind you, when you're walking home at night, your first instinctive automatic reaction is to think there's someone there. There's nothing you can do about that. That is a product of hundreds of millions of years of evolution, according to those that take this adopt this theory. I'm not endorsing that theory. I don't need to endorse that theory. All I'm pointing out is that what that theory attempts to explain is a fact. We are just horribly, horribly prone to false beliefs in extraordinary invisible agents based on such subjective experiences.
Well, very helpful. You've definitely laid out a strong counter example then, a counter argument there to justified belief in God, this properly basic belief in God. So coming back to you, Tyler, and feel free now, guys, to sort of, you know, chip in on each other as we go along. Lots of ground to cover there, though, Tyler. Firstly, you know, people have beliefs that, you know, on your theory, they could be warranted for believing in all kinds of strange phenomena, psychics, ghosts, demons, you know, all kinds of exotic other gods and religious beliefs that people around the world have. So how do you sort the wheat from the chaff, as it were, in these cases? And what do you do about Stephen's problem that we're fundamentally flawed when it comes to thinking that there are invisible causes for things, and we've been proved time and again wrong on that front, and so we should be very sceptical, I guess, of our belief in an invisible agent, i.e. God, in this instance.
Sure, yeah. Thanks, Stephen. Sure. So one thing before I give sort of my thoughts on Stephen's comments, it does seem like, and Stephen, you can correct me if I'm wrong, it does seem like that at least you're willing to allow some people, say uneducated people about cognitive science of religion, or perhaps individuals who aren't in an area in which there's, you know, a lot of religious diversity, you're allowing them to be rational when it comes to believing in God apart from argumentation.
Is that the case, Stephen?
Yeah, in principle, if people don't have the new evidence, then they're in this that, you know, they are a member of a species horribly prone to false positive beliefs in invisible agents. If they don't have that information, well, then they don't have the undercutting defeater. It's a bit like someone who's looking at the snake and thinks that there's a snake there, but they don't yet have the information that they've been drugged with a drug that causes very convincing snake hallucinations. Of course, it's reasonable for them to believe that there's a snake there under those circumstances. However, the vast majority of us, certainly right across the West, are more than familiar with this information that I've imparted to you about, you know, how prone we are to false positive beliefs in invisible agents is not really news, is it? We've known this for a very long time, and so they're fully aware of this defeater.
Okay, go ahead, Tyler.
Yeah, so I agree with Stephen that educated folks are, but I don't know. Perhaps our friends are different, Stephen. Maybe it's because I'm from the South or something, and then you went to Oxford. But I think I know a lot of people, probably who uneducated individuals, who probably wouldn't know a lot of this information, and thus for them, I think even granting Stephen's argument or response, which I don't, I'm about to respond to, it would seem possible that. Epistemically possible. So when I say epistemically possible, I just mean possible given what we know, that belief in God can be properly basic for some.
Okay.
I was never denying that it could be properly basic in principle. The problem is that very many of us, and certainly you, Tyler, have a defeater. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Sure. All right. Well, I don't think I do.
But he's gonna now counter what your defeater. But let's hear you counter that and then hear what Stephen has to say.
So again, thanks, Stephen. I think you put that all really well. First things first, I guess. I want to tackle the sort of better safe than sorry mechanism that Guthrie sort of advocates. It's sort of become, a pretty popular theory. And sort of explaining why we believe in supernatural things, why we believe in God or gods or fairies, right? Mm-hmm. I think one of Stephen's arguments that he gave was that, hey, this sense of the divine that we're talking about, it's unreliable because, hey, it produces belief in fairies and other gods and different sorts of gods and different aspects of God, so it's unreliable. Well, it's not. The detecting agency isn't unreliable insofar as it detects humans or objects that are moving and so forth. In our everyday life, that faculty indeed is reliable, at least insofar as it goes to that. Now, you may say, well, it's unreliable insofar as when it detects agency, when invisible agency or something like that. There's sort of, I think, two sorts of replies that one can give. One reply by Barrett and Clark, I'm not sure if you've read this, you probably have, but the reply is something like, the sense of the divine, even Calvin said that this was sort of an unclear knowledge of the divine, of divinity. And so if all this sensus divinitatis purpose, if all the sense of divine's purpose was to make us aware of the supernatural, make us aware of divinity, then it isn't unreliable. It might take on a whole bunch of different forms, given different cultural preferences and cultural stories and so forth, but insofar as its purpose is to make individuals massively aware, globally aware of divinity, it's not unreliable as far as that goes. There's another sort of reply that basically says that, Christians' faculties are functioning properly. Hey, the Spirit has repaired them from sin. Sin has damaged the faculties. The Spirit's repaired it. And lots of people growing up in Western tradition and the Middle Eastern tradition have had the benefit or blessing of having their faculties develop in such an environment where there's so much truth about God. And this has somehow aided in their cognitive development. So basically it's saying that sin predicts that we would have all sorts of diverse beliefs, religious beliefs. There's something missing from our cognitive faculties, an ability, a power, a grace because of sin. And so, but upon having that grace, upon having that power restored to us, then we're not talking about an unreliable cognitive process, at least for those who've had it repaired to a sufficient degree. So those are the two sorts of responses to that. I don't know, Justin, if you want me to respond to the religious diversity in general or if you want me to leave it there.
Well, let's leave it there for the minute because that okay. gives us... But these are responses to the idea of why there might be different things that people end up believing about God. What do you say to this first response that, at least we've got the idea that there is generally an awareness of the supernatural going on? And secondly, this claim that perhaps Christians have had their faculty repaired at some level by the Holy Spirit, and they're if you like specially given access to the truth about God on top of that. Stephen.
Yes, I'm glad Tyler raised that point because it allows me to explain a little bit more exactly what I am and am not saying. So in fact I'm not saying what I think Tyler possibly thought I was saying. It seemed to me that, well, let's go back to the snake case where I seem to see a snake lying on the grass in front of me. It is reasonable for me to believe that there's a snake there under those circumstances. But then I get the new information that I have been drugged. Very good evidence that I have indeed been drugged, given a drug that causes incredibly convincing snake hallucinations. Under those circumstances, pretty much everyone is agreed that it's unreasonable for me to now continue to believe that there's a snake there. And that is true even if, as a matter of fact, the new information I've been given is false, even if, as a matter of fact, I've been lied to, even if, as a matter of fact, that is a real snake that I'm looking at, and my senses are indeed functioning in an entirely reliable way.
Mm.
So what I'm saying is that when you're presented with these undercutting defeaters, it's no longer reasonable to believe that things are as they appear to be, even if, as a matter of fact, your senses are functioning reliably. My claim is not that your senses are not functioning reliably. My claim is that you should not rely on subjective experiences under those circumstances, given this new information. That's the claim. The claim is not that your senses are unreliable or are functioning unreliably under these in this particular case. They may well be. Maybe Tyler really experiences God.
Mm.
Even if he does, it's not reasonable for him to believe that he does, given the information that I've given to him.
And this information turns on Tyler, this idea that Stephen has, that we are extremely prone to false beliefs about invisible agency.
On the basis of particularly of this kind of subjective experience. I mean, Tyler knows that, surely. But then he knows he's in a position similar to the person who's been told that they've been given a drug that causes snake hallucinations.
So this is a probabilistic sort of defeater?
What do you mean by that, Tyler?
Given the probability of evidence, namely being I've taken this hallucinant and so forth, having a hallucination, some sort of cognitive malfunction.
It needn't even be probable if it's just if there's a significant risk that that's not a real snake, but it's a hallucination, then it's no longer reasonable for me to suppose that there's a real snake there, even if, sure, as a matter of fact, yeah.
So it can be inscrutable, you know. Okay. All right, well, you can go ahead and continue to respond, Stephen.
Why don't you respond to this, though, Tyler? Because I guess we are getting to the point of does Stephen's thing about we're prone to being fooled, is that a defeater ultimately then for your you think is your justified belief in God?
Sure. So thanks for clarifying that, Stephen. My take is that... So as sort of a good externalist, and there are indeed individuals to the right of me of this, what I'm about to say, such as Jennifer Lackey, when it comes to religion, if my faculties are functioning properly, if I've literally been designed, or let's take the snake example, since Stephen brought that up. I think generally most of us want to say, yeah, of course, of course, we wouldn't be warranted and believing that there's a snake there, because it's not as if we're intuitively think that we are designed to produce, programmed, hardwired to produce the belief that there's a snake right in front of us. And in that instance, most of us don't think that that's going to be the case, given that most of us will think that we're quite pulled by the intuition that we took some sort of hallucination pill, and that's, you know, we're going to question if we are indeed hardwired. But if we do think about, hey, in the religious case, there is all sorts of diversity that does exist, and nonetheless, I'm still very convinced. I have non-propositional evidence that has convinced me greatly that I do have this sensus divinitatis. My faculties are indeed functioning properly. They are aimed at truth. I sort of have the key here is in the firmness in which I hold the belief. So in the case of me believing that God exists or that Christianity is true, I have what some philosophers call psychological certainty or just really firm belief, basically. I'm holding this very strongly. And as long as my belief, my strongly held belief, my psychologically firm belief, is the product of properly functioning faculties aimed at truth, and there's an objective, a high objective probability under these conditions that the belief produced under these conditions will be true, then this belief would be warranted. I don't know what more you want. I mean,
isn't Stephen's point that he has presented you with some undercutting defeaters, namely that you're very prone to see agency where, in fact, there is none. And that, therefore, you shouldn't trust this sense you have because it's let you down in so many other areas. So what's your response to that specifically, Tyler?
So my response is that even upon reflecting of this information that Stephen said, you know, we're prone to predicate teleology even when it's not there. Upon reflecting that information, I'm considering it, and it's still not moving me. It's still not moving me to affirm that my experience is that God exists or that Jesus's tomb is empty. Mm. It's still not moving me doxastically. It's not moving my belief formation at all. And I'm still affirming these beliefs very strongly. And as long as those beliefs are held strongly and they're the byproducts of these really tight conditions, I'm literally hardwired. If I was hardwired to produce this belief and everything's functioning properly and there's high objective probability, again, I mean, I don't think that you would say that I'm irrational.
We'll come back to this in a moment's time because we're going to another break. Time's flying by, and we'll have another 10 or 15 minutes to keep going at this between Stephen and Tyler, asking, is believing in God properly basic today on Unbelievable, in a philosophical edition of the programme? And we'll hear what Stephen has to say, our atheist guest, in response to Tyler's belief that actually, no, he's still perfectly warranted, justified, whatever philosophical term you want to believe in belief in God. So come back again for the programme that aims to get you thinking, certainly aiming to get the grey matter going today on Unbelievable. In a short moment, as we have our third part of today's discussion.
Meet the mission field on your doorstep in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. From happy moral pagans and hipsters to alpha males and atheist memers, we'll introduce you to the new tribes who need to hear the gospel in the UK today. Plus, read our in-depth interview with the UK's former chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, the ethics of boxing and mixed martial arts ahead of this summer's Olympics, post-Brexit news analysis, and practical ways to connect with God in your 9-to-5 job. All that plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists. Subscribe today or request a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week for dialogue and debate. If you want to get in touch, you can do so, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. But we are postponing your feedback during the month of August. We'll postpone it for September. I'm bringing you a variety of interviews with different people that I've managed to have recently. We're going to squeeze in an interview today with Scott Klusendorf about the Clarkson Academy. That's a weekend at the end of September training Christians in pro-life apologetics. So stick around for that after Stephen and Tyler have finished their discussion today on basic beliefs. Also, quickly want to let you know about an event that I'm hosting come October. This is going to be the Rethinking Hell Conference. So it's going to be held here in the UK, London, between the 7th and 8th of October at Highgate International Church. Speakers like Roger Forster, David Instone Brewer, and Chris Date, who runs the Rethinking Hell website, will be there. I'll be hosting that. Essentially, it's an occasion for evangelicals to consider the case for conditional immortality when it comes to theology around hell and the movement's ongoing direction. If you want to find out more about tickets and further details, rethinkinghellconference.com. That's rethinkinghellconference.com. Again, London, October the 7th to the 8th at Highgate International Church. I hope you'll be able to come along if that's something that would be of interest to you. Next week on the programme, I'm very pleased to say that we'll be hearing the first of a two-part conversation that I had recently with Derren Brown. He's the UK's most famous mentalist and illusionist. He was once a Christian. He's now an atheist. He's going to be talking to me about faith, theology, storytelling, whether miracles really happen. He's just come to the end of a sellout run of his show Miracle, one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, really, but very much with its sights set on evangelical charismatic healing and miracle claims. So we have a conversation about all kinds of things, including that, and you'll be hearing the first part of it at this time next week. Hope you can come back for that. Right now, time to finish off this discussion on properly basic beliefs.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding this discussion today on whether believing in God is properly basic, it's been a pleasure to be joined by Tyler McNabb and Stephen Law. Tyler is a PhD student, University of Glasgow, specialising in epistemology and philosophy of religion. I hope if you're not a philosopher, though, you've been able to keep up with some of the terminology. We've been trying to explain it and use helpful analogies as far as possible during the course of the conversation. Stephen Law is atheist philosopher and provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK, very sceptical about claims about belief in God, and been explaining why he doesn't see that Tyler's view that believing in God is properly basic is actually in fact justified, given how much we're aware today of the fact we can be easily fooled when it comes to these kinds of beliefs. So where do we get to? And we'll try and cover as much ground as we can in the remaining time, gentlemen. Stephen, Tyler's saying there that even though you've presented him with this defeater, that he can be fooled and that you've got plenty of evidence of that happening, I think what Tyler's saying is simply that the belief he has is strong enough that it just hasn't been moved by that. And so he's still rationally justified in believing in God. It just hasn't really changed his mind effectively on this. And so you've just got to accept that he's still rationally justified in believing in God. So how do you come back on this?
Well, if someone finds that they just can't shake the belief, even after they've been given this evidence that they face an undercutting defeater, then I certainly don't want to attach blame to that person, because after all, they can't help it, can they? I mean, if I continue to believe that there's a snake there, I just can't shake the belief that there's a snake there, even after I've been given this incredibly good evidence that I've been given a drug that causes snake hallucinations. Well, I can't. It's not that I'm culpable. I mean, I have no choice but to hold the belief.
You probably feel rather sorry for that person, though, don't you?
Yes, you might well feel sorry for that person. But I think that the fact remains that other people looking at me will think, well, they can't help it, but the fact is that the position they're taking is irrational. And indeed, it is, because to just dig in and continue to believe that the widgets are red, that the snake is on the table, or that the earth does not move, even when you've been given ample evidence to the contrary, because you just find the experience so overwhelming, and many people do. Many people did when they were given very good evidence that the earth moves. They just refused to believe it. They just said, look, it doesn't. The people that took that view, I don't blame them for not changing their beliefs if their beliefs were just stuck with them. But nevertheless, they were being irrational given the information that they'd been given. And it seems to me that although I don't want to point a finger at Tyler, poor old Tyler, and say, you're to blame, it seems to me that he is being irrational. And if you want to know why it's an irrational policy to continue to believe when you've been given this new information, it's because it makes, I mean, as a policy, once people start doing that, they make themselves horribly prone to false beliefs. It's a very bad epistemic habit to get into, to just continue to believe, even when you've been given really good evidence that the experience or whatever that you're relying on is under those circumstances really not to be trusted at all.
Okay, Tyler, response?
So two things real quick. One, it's not as if evidence, for example, I have no evidence, unless you want to define evidence very, you know, only in hard propositional terms or something like that. I have evidence. The evidence is you know, this sort of experience or phenomenology that I have, this sort of imagery that I have. So there is indeed evidence there. It's not as if I'm believing without evidence.
No, and the same, of course, is true when I seem to see a snake before me, or when the widgets appear red, or when it seems that the earth is not moving. No, there's a very long, boring debate to be had about what we should call evidence and what we shouldn't, and we shouldn't really. Let's not get into that.
And we're not at this point either going ever at this point in this debate to the kind of, if you like, objective evidences we might talk about on other shows, like the Kalam cosmological argument, the moral argument, and those kinds of things. We're kind of in a sense, we've shelved those to one side, haven't we? And we're just concentrating on the basis of the thing I immediately experience, this belief in God. Am I rationally justified in holding that belief? Quite apart from any other arguments. But okay. But come back to this, Tyler. Stephen says, you really think you should continue believing this, but you're still irrational because there's you've given the evidence to show why you shouldn't actually trust sure. your senses in this fact. So I'm still kind of on Stephen's side at this point, asking you, Tyler, are you just kind of being kind of, you know, pig-headed and saying, no, I'm just going to ignore that bit of undercutting evidence and just keep believing in this because I feel like it really is true?
I guess the reason why I was bringing up the evidence statement is because it's not as if I'm ignoring evidence in front of me. I'm looking at the evidence and I'm saying, mm-hmm. well, no, because this experiential evidence is just outweighing that sort of more propositional evidence that's being had. I think Bergman defends this very well, actually as a response to Plantinga's evolutionary argument against naturalism. But to finish my response to Stephen, I find myself really believing that this sort of sin story is true. It rings true to me. And it's like, so this is why there is such diversity in religious belief. Mm-hmm. This is why this faculty is unreliable. It's sin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems true to me. I sort of find myself believing that's true. It explains that that's the case. If this sort of finding myself believing that the sin story is true, finding myself believe that God exists or that Jesus' tomb was empty, if these beliefs are being held very firmly and literally, and I want to continue to stress this, if almost you can picture a robot or something, if something is designed or hardwired to produce this belief, and there's objectively high probability in the design plan, then it does seem to me that the individual would have a warrant in this case.
And is that because...
Well, unless they have an undercutting defeater, and that's what we're looking at.
I mean, is it just that you think the undercutting defeater, Tyler, is relatively weak compared to the experience you have of the way that this strikes you, this belief?
That's right. The sort of propositional attempt at defeater is deflected by this experience and my taking by testimony the story of sin aids me also and understanding why this faculty is indeed...
I mean, do you accept, Tyler, that there are occasions when you are fooled? You're not presumably willing to allow anyone who has a belief in anything to say that they're all rationally justified in believing it, because you think that in some instances it is more likely that belief in, I don't know, Aunt Mabel being in the room with you at the psychic fair is being produced by something else. It's kind of my question, does it allow this free-for-all that Stephen says it does allow if you start going down this route?
Yeah, so one, I do acknowledge that there is diversity. That's why I'm bringing in, I accept the story of sin, by testimony. Mm-hmm. Someone says Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. I'm like, yeah, that seems right to me. Okay, someone tells me the story about sin and telling me that's why there's religious diversity. I'm like, yeah, that seems right. Mm-hmm. If my faculties were functioning properly upon accepting this, I mean, then I would be warranted in affirming that. Mm. Maybe Stephen doesn't affirm that, but that's a different story. But in regard to religious diversity, no, I don't think all sorts of religious beliefs could have this view. In fact, I've published a couple papers, Religious Studies, International Journal of Philosophy Theology, and partly arguing that that's not the case, and that there actually are particular conditions nearly unique to the Judeo-Christian worldview that will allow for beliefs to be warranted apart from argument in this Plantagian way.
Let's have another response from you, Stephen.
Yes, well, I don't want to lose the audience by getting into all sorts of complications. So I'm going to try and keep it simple. But okay. Yeah, so Tyler is appealing to sin in order to explain the diversity of religious experiences. And This is a sort of Plantingian move. I mean, I don't have these kind of experiences, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Many people don't, or they have different kinds of experience of different gods and so on. Why is that? Well, Plantinga's explanation is that although we're all equipped with a kind of a god sense, in many cases it's not functioning properly. It's been corrupted by sin, he suggests.
Yes.
And so my sin-blocked sensus divinitatis is not picking up God, my God, you know, my God Ariel is not functioning properly, but if I could just clear things out, get the sin out of the way, then I could know that God is real. That's an explanation he offers. It's what's known as a just so story. It's entirely ad hoc. But yeah, you can try and explain away diversity and the fact that some people don't have these kind of religious experiences in that kind of way. Unfortunately, the sin explanation at best only works really for religious diversity. Most of my examples actually were not religious diversity. They were experiences of angels and fairies and ghosts and psychic Sally's experiences of dead people in the room with her and so on. I'm not quite sure how sin would explain all of that.
Does sin cover those types of supernatural beliefs for you, Tyler?
So earlier, I gave two sorts of responses to the objection that our census of Venetatis isn't reliable. I referenced Barrett and Clark's view, which I won't get into again. But the second response, I said something like that that original man, however you want to gloss that, had completely properly functioning faculties and in regard to detecting God, to detecting spiritual things, and that losing that power, it went all astray. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps some people do believe in supernatural agencies, ghosts and psychics and so forth, psychic realms and so forth, due to sin.
Yeah. So for you, all the diversity of supernatural experience, not just different religions, could fall under this sin category. But for you, your problem is it's very ad hoc. You say, Stephen.
What reason have we to believe that this explanation is true? And the answer is none, other than it really, really seems that way to Tyler.
It really seems that way to tradition. But yeah, for the most part,
yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. But the other thing is, of course, in many cases, we know that the correct explanation for why people are having these experiences is not sin. I mean, in many cases, you know, Skeptical Inquirer has successfully debunked and explained what was really going on in many of these cases, and it certainly had nothing to do with sin. It was something else that was going on, certain sort of cognitive biases and so on were kicking in. So it wasn't sin, it turns out. But in any case, here's an analogy. So you wanted analogies, Justin. So I'll give you an analogy. I mean, suppose somebody believes that they have a spirit guide, and that this spirit guide communicates with them and gives them messages and advice and so on, and they're really convinced that they've got a spirit guide. I then give them the evidence that I gave Tyler about just how prone we are to false positive beliefs in such invisible, extraordinary agents, and that this really should provide this person with an undercutting defeater. I mean, they can be agnostic. They can say, well, maybe there's a spirit guide there, but I can no longer really trust my experience, given I know just how prone we are to having unreliable, false experiences of this sort. So this person then says the following, but look, I just can't shake my belief that I have got a spirit guide. And it seems to me that when I think it through, that if the spirits were there, they really would want to communicate with me, and they really would make some mechanism available so that I could know that they were there. So why is it that other people have different experiences or don't experience spirit guides? Well, I can cook up some stories. The spirits are aware that many people are not yet ready to receive the message from the spirit guides, or they're unwilling to accept the message from the spirit guides, or they've been corrupted by contemporary materialism. They're too focused on the physical and material possessions and so on to be truly receptive to the spiritual dimension and so on. I can carry on like this all day.
So basically, everyone can cook up an ad hoc just so story.
Everyone can cook up an ad hoc explanation in that kind of way in order to try and defend their belief. And the fact remains that this person who continues to believe in spirit guides, I'm not saying they're culpable, because it may be that they just can't help it, but the fact is their policy is an irrational policy, because digging in and continuing to believe when you've been given an undercutting defeater is just a bad policy. If we adopt that as a general strategy, we are going to be in all sorts of trouble.
We're going to have to start wrapping it up, folks, so I'll ask for kind of some final thoughts really at this point. So you probably want to respond again here, Tyler, but if you can do that and kind of start to draw your thoughts together as well, that would be great.
Yeah. So I think in Stephen's story, if indeed that individual was hardwired to believe that they could talk to ghosts and their faculties
spirit guides and whatnot,
and their faculties are aimed at truth, and there's a high objective probability under the conditions the belief being produced would be true, and they hold this really firmly, and they thought about your defeater, but the non-propositional evidence that they have, their experiential evidence, outweighs the propositional evidence that is given, then I think they would be warranted. I'd absolutely have that intuition. And in regard to sin being ad hoc, I mean, it's pretty huge in the Christian tradition. I mean, it's not as if this is a quick explanation after this, you know, after contemporary cognitive science of religion has given us this story. But lastly, again, if you don't like the sort of sin explanation, see Barrett and Clark's paper, where, again, they argue that perhaps it's just God's intention to bring about awareness of divinity, and upon gaining further knowledge, we can more finely tune this faculty to be reliable. And it is upon the Spirit testifying to us about the truth of the gospel that we find out that God's a certain way, and it's upon finding out that through science that fairies don't exist that we finally tune that. So if you don't like this sort of sin explanation, there is still this other sort of explanation that you might be more akin to receive.
We're final thought from you, Stephen, just as we start to close things out. I mean, I'm getting the sense that fundamentally do you think that this whole thing is a bit of a sneaky way to avoid having to give proper evidence for supernatural beliefs?
Sneaky is a strong term. It's just one of the what we've got here is a strategy which has been used throughout history by people that believe in spooky stuff to say, well, you can't prove there is no so and so, no ghosts, no fairies, or whatever it might happen to be. Plus, I just know that there are, and it doesn't matter what you say or what evidence you give me. I'm just going to dig in and keep on believing. And if it really seems to me that there are there and that they are communicating with me, well, then I'm entirely entitled to believe that. People have always done that, and what we're looking at here is some sort of philosophical gloss added to that basic strategy. But it's the same old strategy.
It's the same strategy.
And it seems to me, it's not a rational strategy.
Okay, thank you so much for being on the program today, Stephen.
Thank you all so much.
And Tyler, if people want to find out more about it, your website is tylerdaltonmcnabb.com and stephenlaw.blogspot.co.uk. Tyler, you're going to carry on believing, presumably, even though Stephen...
And I don't blame him. And I must say, Tyler David gave... I mean, he gave it a really good shot there. I mean, it was very clear and well explained, and we got into an awful lot of nitty-gritty, and yet I suspect that most of the audience will have followed most of it, so I think we did great job.
Yeah, I think I managed to follow. I think many people will have been able to follow. Tyler, in the end, I guess for you, despite this defeater that Stephen really thinks is there, just so that I can encapsulate in my mind, your view is simply that if the belief appears strong enough to you and you know that your faculties are working properly and everything else, even if there is this awareness that we can get fooled, both because of the issue of sin that you've spoken about, you still feel the person who holds that belief is rationally justified in holding that belief, even though obviously Stephen thinks that, I guess it's an impasse almost we're at, where Stephen thinks, no, you cannot be rationally justified in holding that belief if you have this evidence that I've given you. And you simply say, that's not strong enough to counteract my very firmly held belief that I have got an experience of God.
Yeah, and to thank Stephen again, I thought this was good and fun. To answer your question, I think this really boils down to whether you take the sin view that explains religious diversity, we lost this sort of power in our faculty that now it's sort of acting up in a whole bunch of different ways, or you take Barrett and Clark's view where the sensus venitatis point was just to make us aware of divinity. It, regardless of which view you take, I think it comes down to your intuition on, and Stephen, I'd love to hear if you agree, on if an individual can contemplate an attempt at propositional defeater not be moved by it because of experience, because of non-propositional evidence, and think that that person can still be warranted if that belief and evidence is in line with these sort of really tight conditions, I think, that makes the belief really tight, has a tight connection to truth. They're really hardwired to believe it. The design plan's super good. It's aimed at truth and so forth. I think that's what it comes down to. If the individual thinks that a person can know, like it can be warranted in light of those conditions and in light of a firmly held belief that is a result from those conditions.
Well, look,
if the propositional evidence isn't, even if there is propositional evidence that counts against it.
We'll have to let that debate continue in the comment section for the moment. But thanks both for being on the program, and I really appreciate spelling out very lucidly what can be, you know, a bit of a complex argument. But again, if you want to comment yourself, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and why not check out the comments underneath this show? Lots of people interested in these kinds of arguments will be leaving their thoughts there. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable for the latest edition of the show. In the meantime, thanks again to Stephen and Tyler for being on the programme with me today. Do check out their blogs, and look forward to you coming back again, Stephen, once your book on the evil God argument
is written. Stephen with a PH. Because people search for me on the internet, they never find me because it's spelled. Stephen with a PH.
All the very best, and thanks for being on the programme today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you'd like to get in touch about today's show, as ever, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. You can, of course, send me your thoughts on Twitter and Facebook as well, @unbelievablejb for the Twitter account, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook account. I've never really recommended this, but if you listen on iTunes, why not rate the show there? Give us a review or something, because I understand that helps other people to discover Unbelievable, and we're all about that, aren't we? So if that's the way you listen, do feel free to recommend or rate the program on iTunes. I mean, a good rating preferably, but you know, I leave that to you. In any case, it's a great joy to every week be contacted by new listeners of the show around the world. It's a pleasure to have joining me by phone now Scott Klusendorf, who of course is well known around the world really as an advocate for the pro-life position, for the rights of unborn children in the womb, and he's been leading training in that for many years, and he's coming over to the UK along with some other speakers for the Clarkson Academy, taking place at the end of September. It's the weekend that spans the Friday the 30th of September to Sunday the 2nd of October, and Christians are invited to go along to Ashburnham Place, where this apologetics conference is taking place around defending the rights of the unborn and arguing really for the pro-life position, in order to really be trained up by some of the leading people in the world, including of course Scott himself. So Scott, welcome along to the program.
Great to be with you, Justin.
Scott, you've been on yourself before, of course, in debate with people regarding the issues and ethics of abortion. Why should Christians be coming along to the Clarkson Academy, specifically a whole weekend, really, of teaching on this issue?
You know, it's interesting. More than one Christian apologist, Justin, has made the observation that in years past, the debate for Christianity has been, who is God? Now what we're seeing in the culture is a debate over what is man, what makes us valuable, what makes us special, why should we have rights to anything? And the debates that come on those subjects relate to abortion, doctor-assisted suicide, and these are issues Christians need to know how to engage persuasively. And on the pro-life issue in particular, Justin, Christians need to know how to do three things. Number one, simplify the debate. Number two, make a compelling case using arguments that secularists cannot dismiss. And three, handle objections winsomely and attractively to make the most impact in the culture. And we'll be teaching people how to do that at the Clarkson Academy.
Just to remind us before we go any further, what is the place people should go to find out more about this event?
They should go to theclarksonacademy.co.uk. Again, theclarksonacademy.co.uk. www.thomasclarkson.co.uk. Of course, Thomas Clarkson was the one who assisted Wilberforce in abolishing slavery in Great Britain. And we believe that by modeling some of the tactics and strategies that they used, we can see an end to an abortion-loving culture in our time.
You say that you're going to be training Christians to make a case that even secularists would find difficult to dismiss. That's because, as far as you're concerned, a scientific and philosophical case can be made for the rights of unborn children, quite aside from religious considerations necessarily.
That's correct. Here's a 36-second defense of the pro-life view, Justin. The science of embryology tells us from the earliest stages of development, you were a distinct, living, and whole human being. And there's no essential difference between that embryo you were and the adult you are today that would justify killing you back then. Differences of size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency are not good reasons for saying you could be killed then but not now. We will teach people how to defend that 36-second soundbite using evidence, using arguments that anyone can relate to.
You're obviously well-versed in the culture out in the US as regards this issue. Where do you think it's moving here in the UK? Are we becoming more, if you like, liberal on this issue? Are we moving in the other direction and seeing reasons to move back the time limit, at least, for abortion in the UK?
Here are the hopeful signs in the UK. Everywhere we've gone to speak on pro-life issues and reach out to Christians and lay out a case for the pro-life view, they are literally thrilled that someone finally did this for them. They've never heard the arguments laid out and spelled out in a compelling way. Culturally, that's important because the UK, given it is largely an atheistic country, or at least in practice that way, if not ideologically, what happens is you have a hard time making a case for human value. I mean, if the universe came from nothing and was caused by nothing, human beings, whatever their stage of development, are cosmic accidents. And that leads to a very difficult foundational base for convincing people that humans have value. By bringing arguments that reawaken their moral intuitions, using imagery to help reawaken their moral sensibilities, we get to re-engage that discussion on ultimate foundations. And I think that's key.
Just remind us who else will be speaking alongside you over that weekend.
You will have Greg Cunningham, who is the founder and president of the Center for Bioethical Reform. And Greg has done phenomenal work in the UK, reawakening people to the realities of abortion. He has a great quote. He says, "When you show pictures of abortion, abortion protests itself." And he and Andy Stevenson at Abort 67 have done marvelous work reawakening sensibilities on this issue. You will also have myself and Pastor Michael Sherrard, who is with Ratio Christi here in the U.S. He is an expert on going on college campuses and teaching Christians how to engage in a relational manner. And that will be a fantastic addition to this year's Academy.
It sounds really valuable. So if people want to get along, again, can you just remind us of the dates, the place, and where they should book?
Sure. It's Friday, September 30th to Sunday, October 2nd. And for £98, you get two nights at Ashburnham Place. You also get all your meals and the instruction and handout materials. And the website for that is theclarksonacademy.co.uk.
Yeah, it's a fantastic deal, actually, and some top quality speakers and training on offer there if you want to get along to that. Thank you very much for joining me on today's programme, Scott.
Thank you, Justin.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed today's conversations. Let me tell you what's coming up this time next week. You're unbelievable. Well, as I mentioned, the first of those two programmes featuring Derren Brown, probably the UK's most famous mentalist and illusionist. He was once a Christian. I was able to sit down for a rare interview with him about his former Christian faith, why he left it, and talk through some issues around the resurrection, theology, faith, storytelling, and his amazing mentalist illusionist act. We're going to be looking at that in some depth over the next couple of weeks. Hope you can be with me for that conversation with Derren Brown at the same time next week and online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Up next, The Profile.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.